Good morning, everyone. I'm going to open up the Senate Judiciary Committee, and at this time, we're going to have, we got three bills that we're going to take public testimony on, and maybe have possible work sessions on one or two of those. The other thing we need to do is we have a one committee bill proposed for introduction, and Council, why don't you tell us about LC 2277?
Chair, members of committee, LC 2277 creates pilot grant program for county resource centers for post-prison treatment services. So, Chair, members of committee, this is what we refer to as reentry program.
All right, so this is basically a proposing reentry programs for individuals leaving the state corrections facilities and reentering into their communities.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
All right, and the chair would entertain a motion for the introduction as a committee bill, LC 2277.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 2277 be prepared as a committee bill.
All right, is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And at this point, we're going to go ahead and start our public hearings. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 238. We have, it looks like, if I got this correct, four people that are scheduled to give testimony. Lane, I know you're here. Lane, Shutterly, I'd like for you to start off. Is there anyone that you'd like to bring up with you as kind of a panel? So Tim's going to come up with you. And this is just, if I'm reading correctly, is it Orlook?
O'Rourke.
O'Rourke, okay, excuse me. Gentlemen, thank you. Lane, why don't you get us started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lane Shutterly. I'm a private practicing attorney who are in Dallas, and pleased to be with you this morning in support of this bill. I'll just give you a little bit of context and then let Mr. O'Rourke offer some more of the technical testimony. He's passing out to you some written testimony as well as a package of information about this bill from the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws. I mention that because this comes to you as a uniform laws bill. And just by way of background, I am one of four commissioners from Oregon to the National Conference. It's also known as the Uniform Law Commission. And I just want to mention a little bit about how this bill got to you. The Uniform Law Commission is an organization of the states. Members are appointed by various appointing authorities in Oregon. The governor appoints members to the commission. There are four of us from Oregon. I am honored to be one, along with Joe Willis, attorney in Bend, with Schwabe Williamson, also Carl Bierre, a law professor from the University of Oregon Law School, and Judge Martha Walters, judge of the Oregon Supreme Court, who we're particularly honored to have serve as president of the National Conference this year and next. She is president of the organization and the first woman president to chair the National Conference in its 117-year history. The National Conference proposes and adopts laws, uniform laws, for enactment by the states, the idea being that with a uniform set of laws among the states that facilitates interstate commerce, travel, business, and all those things between states where there's a fairly consistent pattern of laws among them, particularly in areas that involve activity between states. And this Guardianship and Protected Person Jurisdiction Act is a classic example of one of those laws where uniformity among the states facilitates private interests in terms of establishing guardianships and conservatorships, and then being able to move from state to state with those guardianships or conservatorships in place. There's not much more I want to say about the bill except to give you a very broad outline of it. It comes to you in mostly four parts. One is definitional. The first part has definitions. The second part deals with jurisdiction, the question of when, what state has jurisdiction over a guardianship or a protected person, and particularly if more than one state may have jurisdiction, which state should go forward with jurisdiction. It's in the effort here is to facilitate conflicts when there is jurisdiction sought or proceedings pending in more than one state to determine a process by which A-State is preferred to go forward. Much expense is spent in some cases on litigating jurisdictional issues as to which state should go forward and claim jurisdiction. The third part of the bill deals with transfers of guardianships and conservatorships. It's a very practical aspect of the bill. If you have a guardian or that is a protected person in one state, but for one reason or another, they need to move to another state. Currently, there's no standard process by which that can be done except having to file a new guardianship or conservatorship proceeding in the other state to which the person is moving. This creates a system whereby when a guardianship or conservatorship has been established in Oregon, and for one reason or another, the protected person needs to move to Idaho, let's say, if it's adopted the Uniform Act, then there's a process basically to move that guardianship or conservatorship to Idaho so that you don't have to start all over again in Idaho to create the guardianship and conservatorship. And the fourth thing the bill does is a process for registration, usually for short-term purposes. Let's say if you've got a protected person living in Oregon who for a period of time has to be hospitalized out of state, you don't want to move the guardianship from Oregon to that other state, but you may want to register it in that other state to clarify that the guardian has authority in that other state to which the person has to be moved for a temporary basis, or if there's property in the other state, clarifying that the conservator in Oregon has authority to deal with the property in that other state. This bill deals with all of those issues, and so it's designed to really make guardianships and conservatorships more portable and to, again, clarify jurisdictional issues when there's a conflict between the states. I'm pleased to present it to you, and I'll be happy to answer questions. And I want to thank the bar, too, for introducing this through the estate planning section. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be quiet now and let Mr. O'Rourke tell you more about it in particulars, but I'll be happy to answer any questions when he gets done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'm Tim O'Rourke. I'm from Pendleton, Oregon. I'm with the law firm of Corey Ballard and Rue. It's obvious Mr. Shetterly has been here before. I was here once a long time ago. Before I get started, I would like to point out that the Oregon Judicial Department has brought a few concerns to our attention. And with your permission, we'd like to form a work group to propose or prepare, offer an amendment or two in the near future to bring back to you. So I present this testimony with that in mind. I think after this meeting, we're going to get together and come up with a timeline, if that's okay with you. But more on a practical matter, the reason that this bill is important to practitioners out in Eastern Oregon and I'm sure elsewhere is two quick examples. I inherited a guardianship proceedings at our office from one of my retired partners, and it was a lady in lived in Oregon. She had two daughters, one in Idaho and one in Oregon. And for whatever reason, and the guardianship was in Oregon, and for whatever reason, the mother had tired of living with the daughter, or the daughter was tired of the mother, I wasn't sure which. And so the mother moved to Idaho, and the daughter over there, she didn't get along with her sister, and so they opened up a Institute of Guardianship Proceedings in Idaho. And so essentially we had two different guardianships trying to deal with mother, and she would move back and forth as she saw fit, and which daughter she liked at the moment. And that's where I became aware of this jurisdictional problem, and it became quite a mess, actually. And there were lawsuits instituted in both states trying to figure out what to do and who had authority and who had control of the assets and the mother. And this bill will address those concerns about what happens when you have a person in one state and they move to another. And fortunately, I was able to find a way out of that mess by having a conflict, so somebody else had to deal with it, so I'm not sure how it actually ended up.
You passed the buck.
Yes. And then the other one, which was another matter, is it was much simpler, but it still caused quite a problem. There was a guardianship in Idaho. A mother was in Idaho. She actually lived in Oregon. She moved to Idaho to be with her daughter. She had one daughter. Her daughter worked for the Idaho Department of Revenue, and she called me up one day and said, my mom has a house in Hermiston, which is not far from Pendleton. She'd like to sell it, but the title company tells her she can't get insurance, title insurance, without instituting new guardianship conservatorship in Oregon. Well, I looked into the matter, talked to the title company, and sure enough, without opening up a new guardianship conservatorship in Oregon, she couldn't sell her home. And so we had to open up a new proceeding in Oregon, even though there was one already in Idaho, because they wouldn't recognize the Idaho guardianship conservatorship. And so as a practical matter, the mother who had Alzheimer's, she was paying for two of these just in order to sell her small home in Hermiston, because there's this conflict between the state. Each state has their own idea of, you know, what a guardianship conservatorship should be, and there's no communication as such between the states on what to do. And that's what, as Mr. Shirley pointed out, that's what this bill would do, is make it easier, assuming we can get, you know, all these states to adopt this act, and that's up to him. That's really all I had at this point, unless you had questions.
Senator Wilquist.
Thank you, Chair. Lane, I see this as we started out trying to get nationwide approval or nationwide agreement in 2007. Any idea where the other states are now? I mean, there's 50 states, so are we the first one, or
thank you,
are there some going elsewhere?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, no. Yeah, this bill was adopted by the conference in 2007. Five states adopted it last year, and of course, that's an off year for several states, even states that meet annually. That tends to be the shorter agenda year. This state, introductions are pending in several states around the country, and we expect this one to be adopted widely and pretty quickly, just because the need is pretty evident, and it also has very broad support. If you look in your packets, the National Conference of Chief Justices, the National Association of Probate Judges, guardianship groups, the sections of the American Bar Association that work with guardianships and conservatorships. So while we're early in the adoption phase, we expect this bill to be adopted widely.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much. We've got two other people want to testify.
Thank you.
Mr. Mark, we are going to have some type of a work group. We will expect that those members who want to be involved with the organizations to be part of that, and then we'll expect there'll be some type of tracking for getting back to us with whatever proposal amendments that will go forward so we can take this up. It's intent of the chairs that we will move this bill. This does seem very important for Oregon to be in line earlier than later in this process, but we want to make sure we cross the T's and dot the I's.
Thank you.
So thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
I have, I believe it's Kyle Dwyer and then Earl Tozer. Or excuse me, Robert Tozer. Bob, why don't you come on up and give testimony together.
Mr. Chair, I'm Kate Dyer Seeley. Clearly have terrible writing.
I'm reading off the yellow sheet, which is a bleed through, and I'd say L versus a T, wouldn't you? All right, Kate, go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me here this morning. I am the public policy coordinator for the Oregon Alzheimer's Association out of Portland, and I'm here to speak in adoption of this bill on behalf of the 80,000 Oregonians who are living with Alzheimer's disease and their 150,000 care partners. As I'm sure you can imagine, due to the impact of dementia on a person's ability to make decisions, and in the absence of other advanced directives, people with Alzheimer's often are in the need of a guardian. The Alzheimer's Association is in support of this act due to the unnecessary legal battles over jurisdiction, which waste a family's valuable time and money in court proceedings. One example is our association learned of a woman who was caregiving for her husband with Alzheimer's disease here in the state of Oregon, and she went through the lengthy process of obtaining guardianship, which cost her over $4,000, and then they moved just across the state line to Washington. She had to go through the process again of refiling for guardianship in the state of Washington and spending an additional $4,000. caregivers of people with Alzheimer's are unduly stressed, both emotionally and financially. And we've heard numerous stories from our people that they aren't even aware of the fact that their rights end at the state line. Additionally, in Portland, we're in an interstate healthcare market, so we have a number of people traveling between Washington and Oregon for medical care. And if a person with Alzheimer's is seen at an Oregon hospital and issues of guardianship come up and they don't have residency in the state, there's no official channel for the states to communicate about what's to be done. There are a number of other scenarios which impact guardianship and Alzheimer's disease, things like transferred caregiver arrangements, long-distance caregiving, which happens a lot with relatives that are living out of state and trying to manage care for a parent, and even snowbirds who are traveling in between states during different times of the year. And unfortunately, Alzheimer's disease is a growing epidemic. We anticipate that 10 million baby boomers are going to contract the disease in the coming decades, which means situations like this are going to be on the rise. We at the association are working to raise awareness not only about the disease, but also the necessity of end-of-life planning. And the current system is just a barrier to addressing some end-of-life issues, in part just because of the disorganization of the states and the lack of communication. So simplifying even this one aspect would relieve a tremendous burden on those with Alzheimer's and their families. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bob, thank you for being here. Give us your...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robert Tozer, T-O-Z-E-R. I'm an attorney in Eugene, although I'm not speaking for the bar. And I'm also the chair of the Leadership Council of the Cascade Coast Office of the Oregon Chapter of the National Alzheimer's Association. So it all trickles down to our local office in Eugene, and that office serves Eugene, Roseburg, Coos County, Curry County. Its reach is extensive. The reach of this bill is extensive too, and although I, from my personal experience, I wouldn't say there's a tremendous need for it right now, there will be. And it might, the tremendous need part may come before you can meet next, so I would encourage this to move forward quickly. There's a lot of good advantages to it. Current Oregon law allows a guardianship to be filed when a person is present in the state of Oregon, and in the county, the county you file it in is the county they're present in. And that can be far from their home. That can be far from their usual place of abode. And to lawyers, that means far from the evidence, far from the doctors, the social workers, the people that care for that person. And although we can file in an emergency in Oregon, then all these other questions arise. How, you know, Oregon statutes allow an Oregon guardian to place their ward, we don't use that terminology anymore, the protected person, outside of the state of Oregon, but that's where the authority stops. And Oregon guardians run into trouble getting medical care for their protected person all the time in other states. We also run into it with conservatorships, where an Oregon conservator, now that's a court-appointed fiduciary carrying certified letters from the Oregon court, and they go down to try to deal with a bank in somewhere in California, and the bank says, we can't do this. We will not give you access to your mother's account. Well, then they call me, and I end up usually calling the bank and pushing this thing called the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution, saying, you have to honor this. This is Oregon judge's order. And as many times as not, they say no. And so the ability to, this is the last section of the act, the ability to register a foreign judgment in another jurisdiction is crucial. We do it in child custody acts, we do it in support acts, we do it with criminals, with the interstate compacts of registration of sex offenders. The model of this is really well established. And to be able to take an Oregon conservatorship letters judgment, file it in Alameda County, California, and go about your business would be a tremendous savings of money to families. A tremendous savings of money to the state of Oregon is maybe in Section 3, and this comes up as well. Section 3 is the transfer provision, and as I read it, it's a situation where an Oregon judge can basically order her guardian or conservator, say, you're in another state, you've been in another state for years, I order you to open a similar proceeding in another state. Now, that's an authority that the Oregon courts lack right now, and have an example. And Son did move his father to California. He's been there now 5 years, and we have an Oregon guardianship and conservatorship open still. And each year, our Judge Holland in Lane County writes us and says, why is this open? We have absolutely no, our state has absolutely no connection to this gentleman. And the answer is always, it will cost this gentleman $5,000 to $7,000 to redo everything in California, even though it's all in place here. And each year we get to get away with it and continue the case here. There are disputes, and this act addresses that too, where she had guardianship, conservatorship of her brother, paranoid schizophrenic. Her sister came in the middle of the night and just took him to Oklahoma. She said it was his desire. My client says, well, I'm the guardian here. But the upshot of it was is there were two proceedings. There was a full guardianship conservatorship in Oklahoma, full guardianship and conservatorship in Oregon, because the two courts have no provision to talk to each other, and fighting among the two jurisdictions. So this settles all of that. We've got the problems of seniors with Alzheimer's that travel. The Alzheimer's Association has initiatives on that very issue about how to, you know, to help people that travel with Alzheimer's that get lost. A lot of people can land in a place they don't know. The authorities there have to be able to react quickly, establish something, some protective mechanism there in the foreign state, and to immediately be able to deal with the home state where that person lives, where their family may be. So the only criticism I have of this act is my only peccadillo, and it's the word upon. It's near the end. Circled it here. Anyway, it said upon registration of the foreign judgment. Upon means up on a table to me, and I would substitute the word after for that ancient phraseology.
Are you looking for a job? And let's let the council. We may have an opening or two.
That's right.
And that's really all I have. Really would urge it. It's a great act. I don't see how it costs the state anything. And like I say, let's the Oregon judges get rid of cases that don't belong here anymore, which could be significant savings. So,
all right. Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Senator.
Thank you, Chair. Bob, you made mention that we're not in an emergency now, but before we meet again, there'll be a tremendous need. Could you just expand on that a little bit? Are we expecting a lot of deaths, or do you have a crystal ball we don't have?
Well,
in 2 years, that would be.
You know, just the staggering numbers of people that have Alzheimer's and other related dementias, and throw that in there too. There are many kinds of dementias that aren't Alzheimer's per se, but lead to a person to be unable to make decisions. And when I started this area practice, you know, I had one case. Now it's basically all I do. There's a number of attorneys that in the state that is all they do. When I started going to seminars that the Oregon State Bar puts on, you know, there might have been 20 attorneys interested in elder law, that is Alzheimer's type thing. The last one I went to was 2 years ago. There were 350 or more practitioners. The issue of Alzheimer's, people being unable to make their own decisions, is creeping into almost every area of law. There was recently a double murder of a gentleman that had Alzheimer's. I guess one survived still. So it has been creeping into criminal law for years, but in civil law in almost every aspect. There's building facilities. It's just the staggering numbers of people that will be entering this system of guardianship, conservatorship. We have focused a lot on guardianship, but conservatorships as well, and that's property. And a lot of people have property in multiple states, and that's a big hassle to round things up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Bob volunteered for the work group with his wordsmithing, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he might have. The other part on this, I think he's just being very polite, just saying the baby boomers are getting older.
Yeah.
So,
quick question.
Well, I'm sorry, the older people are getting older. Life expectancies increase, and the rate of Alzheimer's in people 80 years and older is over 50%. Now, it's not a natural process of aging, it's a disease. And as people, life expectancies go longer, we will have millions of cases nationwide.
Yeah, Judy, just to chime in real quick, our executive director was reminding me that we're anticipating a 93% increase in the rate of Alzheimer's just in the state of Oregon alone, so in less than 20 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you happen to know if our neighboring states are considering this? I'm looking at the map that was in our packet, and it looks like the states that have already enacted it are Alaska, Utah, and Colorado. But what we've heard about today is Idaho, California, Washington. Are they considering the bill as well? See Mr. Shetterly back there shaking.
Yeah. I know that it's been introduced in the state of Washington just this past few weeks, and I don't know about California. Yeah, so Washington just introduced it, for sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you all very much for being here today and giving us your testimony.
Thank you.
And with that, is there anyone else that wanted to give testimony today on Senate Bill 238? If not, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And it is the chair's intent for the parties that are involved to continue to meet. And I understand the Department of Justice will be meeting with you as well to cover some of the points that they've raised. And if you'll work with staff and counsel to get word back to us when the amendments are in a process that we can take this bill up, we would appreciate that. So with that, we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 237. Council?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill, Senate Bill 237 comes to us at the request of the Oregon State Bar. State Planning Section clarifies that the power attorney may become effective at a specified time in the future or upon the occurrence of a certain specified event, such as a person subject to the power of attorney becoming financially incapable. It's referred to as a springing power of attorney, Mr. Chairman.
All right, thank you. And I have one person there signed up for this one, Jonathan Levy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Levy. I'm here to testify in support of this bill on behalf of the State Planning and Administration Section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm the immediate past chair of that group. I'm a lawyer in the Portland firm of Cavanaugh, Levy, Bilyeu, and we specialize in estate planning. Part of estate planning is preparing for incapacity to name relatives or friends to help manage one's financial affairs when you lose the ability to do it yourself. An important tool is a power of attorney, a document by which you name others to manage your finances when you can't. One aspect of powers of attorney that many clients desire is to have it be a springing power of attorney, that is, a power of attorney to take effect upon some future event. Typically, the future event is incapacity. For historical reasons, it has been unclear that a springing power of attorney is valid in Oregon. And the reason for this is it comes down from the English common law, the English case law, which was inherited by the 13 colonies and then by the states. In the written handout that I've given you, it states that permitting springing powers of attorney would put us in conformity with our neighboring states. That's, I think, an understatement. When I last looked at this issue, this is a number of years ago, every state except maybe one other plus Oregon have authorized springing powers of attorney. So they're only, we may be the only state in the country or only one or two that have this. The members of the bar have been aware of this issue for some time. I worked on a couple of bar groups 20 years ago to try to deal with this problem. But in the past, we've coupled this fix with other more controversial aspects of powers of attorney. And this time we got smart and we decided to present a standalone bill that only dealt with this issue. The legislative fix that we propose would simply make clear that springing powers of attorney, which could take effect in the future, are valid. There's also language in the bill to help make clear how you determine when a person is incapacitated, and we think that's useful to avoid disputes about whether the incapacity has occurred. There's also some clarifying language to clean up the existing statute that was suggested by the Legislative Council. I ask that the committee support this bill, and I appreciate the time here, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
Senator.
Yes, thank you, Chair Krasinski.
Sir, how is the position chosen or laid out in the springing power of attorney so that the person who is conferring that springing power of attorney would be able to select the doctor and someone they trust?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the Section 2, subsection 2 of the bill states on line 22 that the power of attorney may designate a person or persons to determine whether a specified event or contingency has occurred. So you can name the person you want to turn on the switch in your own document. If you don't name a person, then subsection 3 says that on top of page 2 of the bill, lines 4 and 5, says that a physician may determine whether incapacity has occurred, and the determination has to be in writing.
Right. Any other questions? Council.
Chairman, Mr. Levy, you mentioned that many other states have springing power of attorney set forth in statute. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Counsel, yes, that's the case.
And my assumption is that we rely upon common law for the use of springing power of attorney?
It's kind of a process of deduction. In the absence of statute, the common law, in the absence of statute and the absence of an Oregon appeals court decision, lawyers and we believe judges would look at common law, the background cases. Since other states have felt that they needed a statute to overrule that old law, we feel the same would apply here. It's a gray area, I concede. I can't predict how a court would rule, but it has had, the absence of authority has had a chilling effect. In a previous career, I was an in-house lawyer with U.S. Bank, and this question would come up. People would come into the bank branches with springing power of attorney. Stevens Nest, which is creates legal forms, has a form like that that's a springing power. And I would advise the branches that it wasn't clear whether the power of attorney was effective, and therefore they shouldn't honor it. And I believe that other financial institutions have taken the same position. So you're in a gray area. The legal effect of springing powers is at best uncertain and may well be invalid, and this would clear up that problem.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 237? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 237. And, Council, I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 237. Is there anything that we need to consider before moving the bill forward?
Mr. Chair, we have a statement from LFO, no expenditure impact. And I believe we have a summer statement from revenue. So this bill is ready to go.
Chair would entertain a motion to move Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 237 to the floor. Propose moving Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion. Any objection? Order. And Senator Dinkfelder, if you'd be so kind to carry the bill, that would be great.
Thank you.
and we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 237, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 235, and Council can give us the overview.
Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 235 comes to you at the request of the Oregon State Bar Estate Planning Section. The bill raises the limits on the value of an estate that may use the small estate provisions from $200,000 to $350,000. Raises the value from $50,000 to $100,000 for personal property and $150,000 to $250,000 for real property that can use the small estate provisions. Apply to those who die on or after the effective date of this measure.
All right, thank you. And individuals wanting to give testimony today, it looks like we have one. Mr. O'Rourke, I believe you're back up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the Oregon State Bar figured that since I was coming all this way for the first one, they might as well have me discuss this one.
Give you the opportunity to have the experience more than just once.
Yes, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Tim O'Rourke from Pendleton, Oregon. Just as background, you may have heard the term probate, and everybody thinks it's an evil word. And they do what they can to avoid the situation of probate. And as I try to explain it to my clients, it's simply the process of transferring title to assets that don't transfer automatically themselves. For example, if you have life insurance and you name a beneficiary on your death, that life insurance will pass directly to your main beneficiary, and you don't have to worry about this process called probate. Well, in Oregon, a simple process has arisen, is available to those with assets with a lesser value, and we call it the small estate process. And what we've done through the Oregon State Bar is just recommend that the dollar limitations be increased so that those people that have lesser assets can use this process without going through the full blown probate process. The probate process can be expensive in that there are notice requirements and other things that you have to do. And so if you meet the requirements of a small estate process, it's much simpler, it's much cheaper, it's quicker, it's easier for the client. And so it's another way to transfer assets that do not automatically transfer themselves. And so we're recommending that you approve of an increase in the limitations for using the small estate proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Bolamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Rourke, just so I want to make sure I understand this correctly, this changes the procedure, and do you anticipate that it would have an impact on revenue to the
Mr.
state?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bolamici. It doesn't change procedure, it changes the amounts. In order to use the law itself, we've had it for quite a while, and the law says presently if you have $50,000 of personal property or less, or $150,000 of real property or less, you can use this statute to transfer the property to, say there's a mother and she has a house worth $100,000 and she has a will and she wants to give it to her son, we can use the small estate proceedings rather than going through the full probate process through the court system. And so all this is doing is asking you to raise the limits for real property to $250,000 and $100,000 for personal property. So somebody comes to my office and says, Tim, my mom died, she has a house worth $200,000. And she has $40,000 worth of cash. Presently, I couldn't use the small estate process. I would have to use the full probate process, which is more lengthy and costly, because the value of her house is more than the limit, and the value of the cash would be more than the limit. So all we're asking you to do is to increase the amount of real property that the client could own and still use the small estate process, as well as increase the value of the cash assets or the personal property. I don't think this would have a fiscal, or I don't believe it would have any sort of impact to the court system, but I guess I'm not the person for that.
Follow-up?
Yes.
If I may, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying to ascertain is whether this affects the amount of tax that estate tax in probating an estate.
No.
I'm seeing head shaking. No.
No.
I just want a confirmation.
It has nothing to do with that. Taxes are a separate issue, whether or not you have to probate something. So, no, this would have nothing to do with Oregon inheritance tax or federal estate tax.
Thanks. Just want a confirmation of that. Thank you.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Mr. Rook, what is the nature of the protections of the Oregon Department of Human Resources? Could you discuss that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wissett, I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
The change we are proposing is limited to increasing the number of estates eligible to use the small estate process. It will not change the protections for creditors and for the Oregon Department of Human Resources. What protections are current there for the Oregon Department of Human Resources?
Oh, well, we send, pursuant to the statute, you're required to send a notice to the State Department of Human Services to notify. That'd be, I'm sure, for issues of Medicaid reimbursement, those sort of things. So none of the procedures that are currently, better way to say it, is the statute hasn't changed at all, just the number, the dollar amount. So as part of a small estate proceeding, because with a full-blown probate, you file documents with the court, you put an ad in the newspaper, you notify all the creditors, you go through that process. And so the state of Oregon wants to make sure that it's, if it's paid out in any Medicaid claims or things, that it is notified so that it can have any sort of a lien or against the house. And so we're just saying that those things haven't changed. I guess a better way to say is nothing's changed other than the dollar amount.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Dean Feldman.
Thank you. I just have a quick question. When was the last time that these values were increased? I didn't see that date anywhere. And then just a follow-up question to that is, how did you come up with these values? Was it based on average market value for homes in Oregon? Just curious how you came up with this, the revised cap.
Chairman, Senator Dingfelder, with regard to the first question, the answer is?
2005?
Mm. Apparently 2000. I think it was much.
We will get back.
We will get back to you. Regarding the second question, I'm not certain I was privy to the meetings about where they came up with the dollar amount. I'm not sure there's any scientific reason for picking these amounts, that cost of living or anything like that.
Let me see. I was going to ask a question similar to that. Do you know how these new numbers would relate to other states? Are we going to be kind of in the middle of the pack, up toward the top, by increasing these new caps?
Mr. Chairman, excellent question, and I don't have the answer to that. I'd have to get back to you. Unless somebody behind me is waving some sort of sign with a number on it, I don't know.
They're very thankful that you're at the table and they're not. So no.
I think they're doing the numbers right now as we speak. I see them scribbling back there, so I'm sure the bar will get back to us if they have that information.
All right. The only thing, I guess, potentially, just for on the caveat of revenue, my understanding is a full-blown probate would cost the probator more money in filing fees than a small estate would be. So potentially the courts would be losing a little bit of money, but that's not one of those things that we're, let's say, focused on. But that's the only thing I could see in the way of revenue impact would be loss of some of the filing fee cost.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It's cheaper to file for the small estate affidavit.
Yeah. See, Mr. Chair, I love this. This is the full unemployment act for lawyers.
Absolutely.
This is the best one I've seen yet.
All right.
It's brought by lawyers.
So any other questions? Mr. O'Rourke, thank you for traveling the distance you did and being here and giving us testimony on this bill as well. Is there anyone else that wants to give testimony on Senate Bill 235? If not, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 235. And I guess first, Council, we do have a statement from fiscal of no expenditure impact. Is there anything that would hold us from moving this forward? I don't see anything on revenue.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have talked with revenue, and there is no revenue impact on this.
All right.
I don't know if the revenue impact statement is caught up yet, but there is no revenue impact.
All right. Then let me ask if, based on the questions that have been asked, Senator Dingfelder, do you want to get the answers to those questions before we take a motion to move the bill?
I'm fine. It was more just I wanted to find out, you know, how often they come back to the legislature and asking how they set those caps. I'm sure they'll get me that information, but
okay.
I'm fine with going to work session.
All right. So we're in work session, and the chair will take a motion to move Senate Bill 235 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 235 to the floor with a due pass. I'd like to speak to my motion.
And Senator Boquist has made a motion to move Senate Bill 235 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to carry it on the floor, but I would
Bar
Association to have the answer so that I can answer the other committee members or if that question is raised on the floor. I do like this bill. This is the unemployment bill for lawyers.
I love it. Any other discussion? Any objections? So ordered, and Senator Boquist and his volunteering will be the carrier of the bill. And if the bar can get that information to him, that would be great. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 235. And that takes care of what we have on the agenda today. Council, is there anything else that we need to go
over? Committee.
I believe we're back here tomorrow at 8:30. If you can just check, we're trying to minimize our time in the committee, but we want to try to have some type of a consistency on our start time. So I will hope to see everyone tomorrow morning. I believe at the designated time of 8:30. With that, we're closed for the day.